Oh, you need.
Point the group to that area.
Oh, right back there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Close the mic. And when it comes time for a question and answer period at the end, if you get up, we'll give you a microphone. And that way, the speaker won't have to repeat the question. Is that right? And remember to hold it close.
The first three questions get a box of White House
chocolate. Oh, brilliant. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, that's fine. Let me know. All right. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us here. I think this is going to be a really interesting discussion on the topic of regionalism. And as we all know, regionalism actually means a lot of different things to different people, particularly depending upon where you live and where you work. So what we've done here this morning is assemble a panel of wonderful speakers who come from all across the country and are going to touch on the topic of regionalism from both a local and a national perspective. And as you can see, we have a very full panel of speakers here in a relatively short period of time for an incredibly interesting topic. So I'm going to be incredibly brief. I'm actually just going to introduce our speakers, and then we're going to jump right into the discussion, if that's okay with everyone. So with that, I'm first going to introduce our gracious hosts here this morning. Mr. Tom Hughes at the end, who is currently serving as the president of Metro, as well as Mr. Andy Cotugno, who is currently serving as Senior Policy Analyst and Chief Operating Officer of Metro. In the Chief Operating Officer's office. I'm glad you corrected me. So thank you to you both for being here and also for your staff making arrangements so that we could hold this panel discussion in the council chambers. Thank you. And next, we have Mr. Mark Murakami, who is a partner with the law firm of Damon Key Long Kupchik Hastert. Did I get that right? Close enough. All right. In Honolulu, Hawaii, Mr. Murakami's practice focuses on commercial civil disputes, land use negotiations and litigation, as well as environmental and general civil litigation matters. All right. Thank you for being here today. Next, we have Ms. Nicole Mead, who is a partner in the law firm of Brown McCarroll in Austin, Texas. And Ms. Mead's practice focuses on the acquisition, leasing, sale, and development of both commercial and residential real estate. So thank you for being here, Ms. Mead. And finally, we have Professor Janice Griffith, who currently serves as the Vice President of Academic Affairs, as well as a Professor of Law at the Suffolk University in Massachusetts. So thank you, everyone, for being here. We really appreciate it. As you can see, we have a very impressive panel of speakers, and if you want to be even more impressed, I would suggest everybody review their full biographies that are currently in the materials that you have with you. And so now, if we can go ahead and jump right into our conversation here, and we're going to ask Mr. Hughes to provide some introductory remarks. President Hughes.
Thank you, Nadia. A quick disclaimer. Well, first of all, welcome everybody to Metro. Appreciate you coming here. And these are the council chambers in which my six-member council and I set regional policy for the Portland metropolitan area. I want to do a quick disclaimer. I noticed on the description of this, it said a group of attorneys and planners are going to discuss issues of regionalism, and the disclaimer is that I'm neither. By profession, I'm a high school teacher for 30 years out in one of the suburban, in Beaverton School District. I guess appropriately, I taught government and U.S. history. So there was some benefit both to my political career and to my into my political career from my educational career. But I'm neither a planner nor an attorney, but I think that it may be appropriate for me to sort of set the stage for regionalism in as much as I just succeeded in winning election to this office with a constituency of about 1.5 million people in a relatively well-attended election. We do vote by mail, for those of you who aren't from Oregon. We do vote by mail here. So even in relatively obscure non-presidential years, we tend to get a very good turnout. And I won by a landslide of 1,000 votes. So I feel actually very fortunate to be here. And let me suggest to you that Metro, as a regional government, has authority, in some cases shared authority, over the kinds of things that regional governments usually have authority over, which is transportation planning, specifically working with our transit authority to plan for major transit projects. We also do transit-oriented development, usually with local partners. We have some authority over land use policy. The circuit court decision actually said we have more than many of us at the local level felt very comfortable with, but we tend to not exercise that as effectively or as much as we might. The area where we do have a great deal of authority, where we have sole authority basically, is for the 25 cities in the Portland metropolitan area. We set the urban growth boundary for all of those cities. So Metro Council is in the middle of a process to establish the land supply going forward in the future for the metropolitan area. And in doing that, we also have a great deal of impact on setting the sort of overall policy for the nature of urbanization. What is the urban form going to be like in the Portland metropolitan area? As we anticipate the growth of this region by about 1 million people over the next 20 years or so. So that's a very important a set of planning opportunities. We also deal with solid waste. We also have sort of acquired orphaned properties, venues that other people got tired of running at a loss, like the Expo Center and the zoo. And when it came time to build a convention center for the region, everybody sort of looked around and said, who would do that? And of course, Metro was the place that they pointed. And so we also run the convention center, in which they actually own and operate the convention center. So we have we also own a golf course and I think 14 cemeteries. So we have an interesting set of issues to deal with.
And three bars.
Oh yeah, at the golf course. Yeah. So yeah, we purvey alcohol and a variety of other things. So we have a variety of issues, and I think that's probably why we maintain down in our basement. We keep them in the basement. We maintain a fairly large, robust, and very competent staff of attorneys to keep us out of trouble, and most of the time. And so let me talk a little bit about that whole issue of regionalism. And to give you just one more kind of factoid about my background, in addition to spending 30 years as a school teacher, I also spent 8 years as the mayor of the city of Hillsboro, which again, for those of you who are not from the region, is a western suburb. It is the third largest city in the metro area with about 92,000 people now. And it also has, over the last few years, developed into probably the premier job engine for the region. So at the moment, Portland is undergoing about, the Portland metropolitan area in general is undergoing about a 9.5% unemployment rate. Washington County, specifically Hillsboro, has about an 8% unemployment rate. And so unemployment is lower on the western suburbs, in part because of the work that we've done over the last few years, based on a plan that the city of Hillsboro developed in the late 1970s, actually when I was on the city council, to have at least 2 jobs for every 3 people in the workforce living in Hillsboro. And we launched into a fairly major effort. One of the things that we know increasingly to be true, and actually probably the reason that at least 1,000 more people voted for me than my opponent, is that I've convinced folks, we've yet to see if that's true because I've only been here 5 months, that Metro really needs to be more actively involved in the issue of economic development. We do the things we've been doing for a long time really well, quite frankly. We manage solid waste pretty well. We've got a plan for that. We manage our venues pretty well. We've got a great zoo, for example. It's a world-class zoo, and we do a good job of managing that. What we have never done as an organization is focus on economic development. In fact, we have, as an organization, spent a good deal of time running away from that issue. So we would set the urban growth boundary, establish the land supply for the region, and say we don't have to consider economic consequences of that in the process of doing that. We can set plan transportation projects, and in the past have always said, but we don't have any responsibility for economic development, so we don't have to consider the economic consequences of how we do our transportation planning. And so what I proposed to add to the mix was a greater emphasis on economic development and to take the experiences that I had in Hillsborough and that I observed in Hillsborough in 4 years on the city council, 15 years on the planning commission, 8 years as mayor. And probably the best case study in Hillsborough, and actually Tim Sercombe, who is on the Court of Appeals, here in Oregon, was our city attorney through much of this and probably knows this story better than I do. But it would be the growth of the Intel operation out in Hillsborough. Hillsborough is now Intel's largest site in the world. They have over 15,000 employees, and in the middle of this recession are about to invest about $4.5 billion, that was with a B, in construction of a new developmental fab. It's a kind of an interesting story, and I think it highlights a lot of how government and business interact, and some of the lessons that I learned that I hope to take to the regional level now. Intel started their coming to Hillsborough in 1978 with a small assembly plant. They always liked us in that whenever they came to us with a project, we got their project done on time, ahead of schedule, usually and under budget, and they liked that about us. But the tax structure in Oregon was such that they could not move a fab plant up here. So fab, meaning fabrication, is where they make their chips, and a typical Intel fab project is about $30 million worth of land, $80 million worth of building, and $2.5 billion worth of equipment. Oregon is one of the few states where Intel operates that charges a property tax on equipment. And so they, much as they liked us, they avoided us for their fabrication process until the state legislature created something called a strategic investment program that allows local government to abate the property tax on a project. And what they do in Washington County is basically they abate the property tax to the equivalent of what they would have charged on the equipment. That got Intel interested. The state legislature also repealed about that time the unitary tax, which several other states had. Oregon repealed ours, and so we ultimately moved to something called a single point of sales. So we only charge corporate income tax in Oregon on products manufactured and sold in Oregon. So for a company like Intel, that was a very good tax environment for them to come into. But what was required then was available land, a workforce, which we had. They began to work with the community college to develop a program for an associate degree in advanced manufacturing that trained people basically to work in fab plants. At the time, we had a number of semiconductor companies coming to Oregon, and so it wasn't Intel specific, but it was good, close enough that they could take advantage of it. Then there was a question of land. We had land that had in Hillsborough that had been brought in during an urban growth boundary expansion in the 80s, but about 500 acres of it was in a failed subdivision. It was Oregon's best example of the kind of scandal that you used to see in Florida, where people sold swamp land at county fairs and in the backs of Popular Mechanics magazines, and this guy had done that and sold an entire lot or an entire development to people from all over the country. And of course, Oregon law says that in order to dissolve the zoning a plat for a development, you have to have the approval of every owner. And so it sat from 1950 to 1980. And then the city began to look seriously at how could we correct that situation. Several private developers had started. They had done an interesting thing where they would buy up two or three lots, and then the fourth and fifth lot would say, oh, yeah, we know what you're doing, and we want a whole lot more money than you gave them for their lots. And so basically the price never would pencil out for the private sector. So we did what in the pre-Kelo days we could then do, or actually the pre-response to Kelo days, and that was we formed an urban renewal district, and we approached the owners of the property. They sent a registered letter out to every owner of the property, said, look, we if you'd have put the price of that property in a bank account 20 years ago when you bought the property, it would be worth about $3,500. We'll give you $3,500 for your lot. If you agree to that, sign the paper, send it back. If you send it back with a voided check, we'll actually put it directly into your bank account. And half the owners signed the letter and sent the check and came back. So we bought half the properties for about $3,500 a lot. We then sent a second letter out to the rest of the owners, said maybe that got lost, you know, in your clutter of mail. Maybe you'd like to reconsider. Here's the offer again. About half of those then responded to the second letter. So at the end of the letter campaign, we had purchased three quarters of the properties. We then went back to the folks who were kind of the holdouts, who were actually demanding, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for their lot, and said, okay, here's the deal. We have the right of eminent domain. We can condemn your property, and what the court will require us to do is to pay you fair market value for your property. We think we've just established that with the other three quarters of the owners. So we could probably get a court decision, favorable court decision, at about $3,500. You know, we'd rather not go to court, so we'll give you $15,000. And the rest of them sold us the land for $15,000. We then dissolved the plat, zoned everything in the northern part, industrial, and the southern part became a housing development. It's called Orenco Station. For those of you who've been out there, it's a model for transit-oriented development. On the property in the north, we placed Intel. Intel has now invested somewhere in the neighborhood of $8.5 to $9 billion. Again, much of it tax abated, but nonetheless, the numbers on that urban renewal district were kind of interesting. We froze $8 million worth of total cash value, did $36 million worth of public improvements, and rolled $640 million back onto the tax rolls 9.5 years later. And that became the center of the economic development for Oregon. Now, unfortunately, that tool is no longer allowed under Oregon law because of a ballot measure that came in the wake of Kelo that says you can no longer use eminent domain to get land which you're then going to give to another private owner. We haven't figured out a way yet to do that kind of land assembly, and that's one of the things that as a region we can look at as we go forward with economic development. The lessons that we learned from Intel is, first of all, that government has to be responsive. We have to find creative tools to overcome problems, whether they're tax problems, whether they're land assembly problems. Our mantra in Hillsboro always was, with Intel, never let a problem get to the corporate level. Because if they're talking about problems in Hillsboro down in Santa Clara, that's not good for us. We want them to talk about problems in Hillsboro up in Hillsboro so that we can deal with those. And that's true, I think, for the whole region. What it means essentially is the region has to stay a little bit hands-off and let the local governments have the flexibility to be able to work through those problems and not create more problems. And that's been kind of part of the pushback between local jurisdictions and Metro over the years that I think we were in the process before I got elected of smoothing that out, and I think we're going to continue to do that. We know from the Brookings study that regions are the key element to doing economic development in the future, and so this region has to step up, and that means the regional government has to be a player in how we develop our economic development program, and that's sort of the new mission that I'm very pleased to say that my staff has taken on with gusto, and I think we're going to move forward very rapidly on that. So with that, let me finish, and thank you again for coming, and I'll pass it off to whoever's next.
Thank you, President Hughes. Professor Griffith, she will be providing an overview from a You're going to provide a very broad overview.
Yes, I'm going to try to talk about the evolution of regional governance, if it evolves, with our two examples that we have now, which are the Portland Metro and the Twin Cities Met Council. They are the only forms of regional governance in the country today. Metro has elected officials. And Met Council, the members of the council are appointed by the governor. So they serve as two examples that we can examine in greater detail. The timeline shows you that municipalities, metropolitan areas, have tried to expand their boundary lines since time immemorial. In the 19th century, we had a number of city consolidations, New Orleans, Baltimore, Philadelphia, San Francisco, St. Louis, New York City. New York City was consolidated with the five boroughs that presently comprise it. Boston was able to annex parts of Dorchester to expand its boundary lines. In the 20th century, there have been a few city-county consolidations. The UniGov in Indianapolis was created by state legislation, and there basically have not been very many city-county consolidations. You have also Jacksonville, Duval County, Louisville, Jefferson County, and in Georgia there's some three smaller consolidations. It appears that there has to be a consensus that develops over a long period of time for these consolidations to take place. And for the most part, there are too many divisions on an economic basis, a class basis, or racial divides for these consolidations to occur. As I pointed out earlier, we've also have the metropolitan regional governance. And this is unique in the sense that these bodies are performing multiple functions. We have a number of single districts or single function authorities that handle one thing, such as sewerage or wastewater or an airport control type of commission. We've reached the point where it's somewhat difficult now in our present economic climate for these single function agencies to integrate their functions. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we are here today, to explore further the benefits of having a regional government that can perform some multi functions. And finally, we have the example of a two-tiered federated government in Dade County, where the county more or less acts as the regional agency, and all of the municipalities are in place as they are in the metro regional governments and perform local functions. The question is, what is regionalism? And you just heard about the importance of economics on a regional basis. And frankly, I think this is one of the drives to have regionalism today, is the fact that we have a network economy that works on a regional basis. So the question is whether we want to have a political body which covers the same area that the network economy covers on a regional basis. A regional area would be one that would be comprised of multiple city centers, villages, counties. Again, it would be a metropolitan wide entity. The reasons to create a regional body is the fact that problems cannot be solved on a local basis anymore. And that includes economic development, affordable housing and community development, and the environment and urban sprawl types of issues. The new regionalists have basically are 3 points. One, again, is the economy is operating on a regional basis. Two, they are very concerned about environmental issues that cannot be solved on a local basis, where the locality may have undertake some adverse externalities that affect other municipalities adversely, and there's a thought that a regional body would be more neutral in terms of resolving some of those land use types of conflicts. And then finally, the social equity issue of using the entire tax base for the metropolitan area so that every municipality does its fair share of taking care of some of the social equity problems. All right, why plan on a regional basis? Again, I keep emphasizing the fact that the economy is going to go beyond the local boundary lines, and there's a whole host of areas that need to have some regional thinking or some solutions, and that is the land use planning area, funding of regional infrastructure, where are you going to put the highways, the bridges, the next convention center, sewerage lines, things of that sort really need to be planned on a regional basis. Parks, trails, open space is a huge issue at this point. If, as a population expands, we are expecting people to live in denser types of environment. We need to make sure that those environments are livable. And every time that there is some kind of a survey, the population shows tremendous support for creating a recreational space. And on a regional basis, the space can be linked together so that you can get a very long trail crossing municipal borders and bike paths and things of that sort. So it's ideal to plan for trails, open space, recreational space on a regional basis. And finally, we have a tremendous emphasis right now in this country on climate change, sustainability. And again, those types of efforts can be planned much better on a regional basis. Now going to turn to the types of agencies that are operating on a regional basis, because they show how the evolution of regionalism may come about. Usually you don't just start with a regional government. You have to create a regional vision. You have to get people to think regionally, I think, or have some sense of a region before you can jump to a regional governance. So traditionally, we have had regional planning agencies, and they have been created for a large part due to the fact that the federal government, for certain types of grants, has encouraged the creation of these particular bodies. The downside is that they can plan all they want to plan, but they do not have the power to implement their planning decisions. So they have no power to override local land use decisions. However, they serve an important purpose in encouraging regional collaboration, networking, providing advice, solutions to problems that require a regional-wide operation. The regional planning agencies also include councils of government. Perhaps one of the best-known councils of governments is the one in Washington, D.C., that covers that whole metropolitan area, including municipalities in Maryland and Virginia. And again, COGs develop comprehensive regional land use plans. They generally have federated boards comprised of elected officials or representatives from all of the different constituent parts in the region. And that sometimes makes it very difficult to develop a consensus. This was true in Atlanta, Georgia, and was one of the reasons why Governor Barnes created GRETA, the Georgia Regional Transportation Authority, because he wanted a statewide metro body to go further than the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, could do without the power to implement its decisions. Next, we're going to go to the Metropolitan Planning Organizations. They were created again as a result of federal law. And since 1973, we've had a number of different MPOs because they've been required to be created in areas larger than 50,000 a population. Most MPOs function as part of another planning or governmental entity. They produce long-range transportation plans, short-term transportation plans, annual planning priority statements, and they ensure that the public becomes involved in the plans. And most MPOs make a great effort to get public participation and input in the long-range plans that they are drafting. So MPOs and regional planning agencies have served to create an awareness of what regional bodies can do. The Government Accounting Office came out with a 2009 report on MPOs, which was a very, very interesting survey of them. And it showed that most of them, 70% of them, are involved in land use planning to some degree, as well as in their transportation planning, and that they attempt to integrate transportation and land use planning. As you know, it's very important to make transportation decisions based on land use decisions. You really have to integrate the two. So, for example, if you're going to set up a light rail system or you need to create a certain amount of density to support mass transit, and so you're going to have to zone in a way to create that density. There have been a number of different corridor developments where transit goes along a particular corridor. This is particularly true in Europe. If you get on a train and you go outside of a major metropolitan area, you will see housing all along the route of the transit system. So, with that known, there has been an attempt by MPOs to try to integrate better with land use planning and transportation projects. However, again, MPOs do not have power to implement their plans and depend upon local governments to do so. The study found that greater oversight of MPOs should be based on what kind of outcomes are we achieving. Federal government has put in billions of dollars into our transportation system, but really has not set up an effective system, or according to this report, there could be a more effective way of perhaps some implementing transportation policy through the funding of transportation projects. Next, I'm going to compare the Portland Metro System with the Twin Cities Metropolitan Council, Met Council. As I said before, one difference is that Metro has elected members and Met Council has a governor-appointed members. Somebody from Twin Cities might argue that having appointed members provides a greater insularity from political pressures on the part of the members, and so that perhaps that is a better feature than having elected members. Metro, studying how effective Metro has been, it strikes me that the preferable way, the most effective way, is to have elected members, because then you develop political support for the regional efforts. In Minnesota, a governor may come in and not be all that excited about metropolitan or growth or regionalism types of issues. And so depending on who that person appoints, they may not be actively seeking to expand, increase, or actually just perform the regional functions. I think Oregon also has been blessed by having some very strong governors in favor of regional governance because they saw what it could do in terms of protecting the environment. The functions performed by the two bodies are somewhat comparable. Met Council, as Metro, serve as long-range planning agencies. They have control over land uses. In the case of Metro, and you'll hear more about this, I'm sure, the Metro ensures that the localities within its jurisdiction carry out the goals that are required by the state plan. So they both review local land use types of decisions and have the power to make the localities conform to the standards that are set on a regional or a state basis. And then, as you have heard, Metro is involved in regional waste, open space, preservation, parks, air and water quality. The same is true of Met Council. They were originally created to solve a wastewater problem, and they have expanded, however, into transportation. Both of them have been very active in the preservation of open space and the creation of greenways. There are a few other models that one might examine if one was interested in creating a regional government. A very interesting model from British Columbia. They have regional districts. And these districts seem to be fairly flexible. Local government can petition to have certain functions of its functions transferred to this regional district to perform on a regional basis. The districts can be consolidated or they can be dissolved, and even landowners can petition to have the creation of a regional district to perform certain kinds of services. And then also in this country, we have some regional land use commissions, and they are generally have been created to preserve areas where there are very critical state resources or areas where there is tremendous environmental concern. And in the case of these regional land use commissions, we have the Cape Cod Commission, Martha's Vineyard Commission in Massachusetts, and we have several in New Jersey. The Pinelands Commission is one there. These bodies are set up like Metro and Met Council in the sense that they review local plans for conformance to the regional plans and the basis of whether land use policies are in conformance with the regional plans. And that, of course, is to achieve environmental protection, not in just one municipality, which would occur in a locality, but to create this preservation throughout a region-wide area. And if you look at these regional land use commissions, they are in an area that's pretty much alike, Cape Cod, in terms of homogeneity and concern about the environment. So that has enabled them to be fairly effective. All right, we come down now to the prospects for regional governance. I am an optimist, so I think the conditions are ripe that we're going to see more regional governance, especially if you in Oregon could tell your story so it gets out beyond your borders. I think there would be a greater buy-in. I know that a number of different municipalities come and visit you regularly, and that usually the urban growth boundary sometimes scares some of these other municipalities off. I forgot to mention that Metro also serves a very important function in terms of enforcing the urban growth boundary in the metropolitan area. But the forces, as mentioned, the economic, the combination of the economic development, doing that on a region-wide basis because we have a regional economy, is, I think, is going to be a factor in at least creating an environment in which people are willing to examine regional governance. Now, we know that there is going to be a certain amount of, could be a local opposition to it, especially since municipalities, localities are very concerned about remaining control over their land uses to protect property values within their boundary lines. And another impediment, if you want to look at it this way, is that the way our constitutional structure, we have the state government and we have local governments. We do not have states do not have a constitutional structure that provides for regional government because we're in a different century now, and these constitutions were created a couple of centuries ago when we didn't have large metropolitan areas. There could be an issue of the state legislature being unwilling to devolve powers to a regional government. But when I asked a lawyer a couple of nights ago in Portland, he said that he had never heard of this as really much of an issue with Metro in terms of the state legislature being concerned that Metro was exercising too many powers and would prevent the state from or be a political force that might not be viewed positively by various state legislatures. In the case of Metro was constitutionally authorized, and I think that helps in terms of it's now part of the structure. There was referenda, there was a home rule charter, and so Metro was really recognized as a government of the or part of the government in the state of as in the state of Oregon. And perhaps other states will move in that direction as well. I think the open space, preservation of open space, is another factor that is going to greatly influence regional governance in the future. Youngstown, Ohio, developed a citywide plan. And even in its citywide plan, it provided for open space on a regional basis. It mentioned the fact that open space should be planned on a regional basis, and in particular mapped out corridors, green space corridors, along the river, along rivers and streams, into a network of green space. And we're going to continue to need regionalism to deal with growth management. We're going to have a huge population increase in the next 30 to 50 years, and that can certainly be much better managed on a metropolitan-wide basis than on a local basis. And again, in this time of economic uncertainty, the cost of providing multiple services by numerous municipalities, it has to be very expensive. So if taxpayers got really serious about how to cut down on expenditures, they would look at a regional form of governance to provide services on a regional basis that might, not in all cases, but could be done perhaps more efficiently. So finally, to grow regionalism, we need to build more regional networks, coalitions. We have to develop a regional vision, which may come easier in some communities than in other communities. In Oregon, people look out and they see Mount Hood, and sort of that reminds them of the environment. They see the very wonderful agricultural area to the south and the necessity to preserve that. In other regions, that environmental effect may not be quite as strong, so it may be harder to build a regional vision. And transportation, the metro area here, TriMet, has done a great job in terms of providing a way for people to move throughout the region quickly. And transportation is going to become even more of an issue as we're going to need to develop more mass transit to cut down on vehicular miles and the pollution that occurs. And then finally, we cannot leave the land use issues where the land use decisions made on a local basis may result in some fiscal disparities. They result in lack of affordable housing. And these issues, again, can be dealt with much better on a regional basis. If we are serious about implementing smart growth measures, that will have to be done on a regional basis. So again, the whole issue of urban sprawl comes up. This country has not, as you know, necessarily tackled that problem. Certainly much more needs to be done, and regionalism is right there at the forefront to address serious environmental issues, including urban sprawl. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Griffith. And I think that sort of discussion of the evolution of regionalism really provides the context in which for us to understand, because as we've seen, it's really different depending upon where you live. I know in California, we're just starting this process with SB 375, and it's what you're raising here is exactly what we're all struggling with right now. So I think that was very helpful. And now if we can turn, I believe Ms. Mead is going to talk to us about what is happening in the Austin region.
Hi, everybody. Good morning. My name is Nikkel Mead. I'm a land use and commercial real estate attorney in Austin, Texas. But I also helped found an organization called the Hill Country Conservancy. And my job today is supposed to be to talk about how that organization sort of developed a grassroots regionalism opportunity to do exactly what Professor Griffith is talking about and really emphasized, which was to preserve open space and trails. So this is really a focus on one particular, sort of a case study on one particular project where we had to piece together from almost nothing a regional approach to make a project, which for us was pretty complicated in our region, actually happen. And I have some brilliant tech person in my office put together some really brilliant slides that fade and do all sorts of tricky things, but we don't have a clicker today, so it may be we may get stuck on some slides, but we'll figure it out. So I don't know how many of you have been to Central Texas, and we think of Central Texas as the big cities being Austin, San Antonio, New Braunfels, San Marcos, Round Rock, Georgetown. Cedar Park. I don't know if any of you have been to any of those cities, but if you were there 10 years ago and you came today, you probably wouldn't recognize it. We are experiencing enormous growth, thanks in large part to our governor, Rick Perry, who is really pressing the issue of economic development, bringing an outrageous number of companies to our region. And you know, I think I saw a statistic recently that something like 6,000 people per month move to our region. And so it's enormous growth for really what is a conglomerate of small little towns who almost don't know what to do with that growth. And so we have been actively talking about the issue of regionalism. Leaders in the community are really wanting regional government, but we've had a real difficult time getting there. A lot of that, I think, we'll talk more about it, but I think a lot of that is that we in Texas don't necessarily like to cooperate and coordinate. We like to do our own thing. We're all about personal private property rights, and there are a lot of turf issues. There's actually a lawyer, at least one I see in the audience, who is one of the major leaders in our community who worked on this project we're going to talk about today, but I'm sure he'll back me up, to Dave Hartman. I think I saw him in the room. I'm sure he would back me up in my statement that we are really having a struggle figuring out how to manage transportation, affordable housing, utility infrastructure, comprehensive planning, economic development, and then open space and trail issues with our many, many, many different governments that we're dealing with. So on this project, we we had six, we ended up all told with about six interlocal agreements between different governmental entities and about 10 different funding sources. And probably could have gotten this project done much quicker if we'd had a regional government to oversee it. Central Texas, like Portland, is a hiking, biking community. So despite all of those other issues that we need to deal with, transportation, affordable housing, economic development, all those that I mentioned, we sort of saw an urgency around trying to figure out how to preserve trails before trails got developed, the land that we put trails on got developed, and how to preserve open space. And so that sort of created the urgency to do this project and sort of make our own regional, little regional government or regional system. So we were, you don't have to change it yet. No, you're good. So what we did essentially was a 30-mile trail system. And that sounds small, but in our community, that goes through several counties and many, many towns and cities. And so a lot of coordination was needed. Why did we choose a grassroots approach? As Professor Griffith said, we, like most of the communities in our country, don't have regional governance. We don't have regional government. We have the MPO. We have a regional mobility authority. We have the COG. But none of those entities, unfortunately, really have the power to implement a project like this one. And I shouldn't say they don't have the power. In some cases, they probably do. But what they lack is funding. They don't have funding to be able to do a project like this. Implementation, they don't really have the tools to implement a project like this. And frankly, they're distracted and have a whole lot else to worry about, mostly transportation. Just as an aside, we are also a community that is trying for the first time to implement mass transit. And so as you guys can imagine, starting that from the ground up is a really complicated process for us and is taking a lot of the time of those the regional bodies that we do have. But we just had so many challenges, no way to share funds between the communities, using bond money from one community to pay for a trail that might be in another community. And so we just had all these issues that we had to address and had to figure out how to deal with. Every issue from staff time, what city or what county staff would participate in the project, who would maintain it, how would we maintain it, how would we pay for maintenance in the long term, and different comprehensive and regional plans that we had to deal with from community to community. So you can change it. We, Hill Country Conservancy, working with primarily the city of Austin, set a goal for open space preservation, not just for this trail project, but overall. So we set what we thought was a modest goal of trying to preserve 50,000 acres of open space in our most environmentally sensitive areas, and gave ourselves a 10-year window to get that done. There, we have about 250,000 very environmentally critical acres that are undeveloped, and so this 50,000 was a part of that 250,000. And you can change it. This just sort of shows you a comparison of the growth in the orange or growth corridors between San Antonio and Austin, and then comparing that to Houston. And the trend is that in that 10-year period that we're talking about, we will have the density of growth as Houston between Austin and San Antonio, which is pretty surprising for us and pretty shocking. Texas leads the state in the loss of rural farm and ranch lands. And as I said, we're a private property state, but we're also a big ranching and farming state. And so ranch land, farmland, heritage properties are really, really, really critical components to our community. So we had to find a way to preserve those most important lands. So this is the area that 50,000 acres focuses on. Just for those of you who might not have been to these areas, this is where it's centralized in Texas. This is where the most urgent need is. You can change it. And you can see, just as this is drawn, all the jurisdictions that are either that either cover the area that we were talking about or are directly adjacent to it, so have a real vested interest in what is preserved, how it's preserved, et cetera. And here's how preservation is sort of looked in that area over a 10-year span. And you can click that a couple of times, and it'll just kind of show you. Most of this preservation was done via individual city governments or county governments issuing bonds and buying those lands for environmental protection. We have not had a history of being willing to exercise condemnation for this purpose, and not even, you know, to addressing the Kelo situation of giving that land to private parties, but even just to preserve them and have those lands held by the public. There's almost a bias against doing that if it's at all possible. And so as you can see, there are lots and lots of gaps between lands, which from an environmental perspective makes those lands less valuable. So our mission was to try to close those gaps. And the trail project that we'll talk about actually creates a trail that strings those properties that those cities and counties already have preserved, strings them together. So we saw all of this as an economic issue, or at least that's what we said. It was the best way, we thought, to sort of sell the concept to the various jurisdictions that we had to deal with. You know, and we told the story again and again that preservation of the Texas Hill Country was all about economic development. That's why people moved to Austin. That's why the governor is able to bring corporations to Austin, because people understand and want that quality of life. And so why do we call it an economic development decision? And how did we sort of justify that? We knew we couldn't just say economic development. We had to sort of expand upon that. And so we talked about the need for these public lands, and by that we meant lands where people can actually go have recreation, take families, et cetera. Another big argument in our community, by the way, has always been, do you preserve those lands and not let anybody walk on them, or do you have those lands for public use? And so we tried to strike a balance there to get buy-in from all the various communities. We also argued that these lands were important for scientific research, that there were we could make it a benefit to conservation buyers, that there were actually private parties out there willing to spend their own dollars in conjunction with the governmental dollars to preserve these lands, so we could really leverage the governmental funds. And then private land preservation agreements, public-private partnerships, and market-driven conservation solutions. So we tried to have sort of a global creative approach. And then you're going to have to scroll. You can just scroll quickly. You don't need to go through each of those. And so the project we call the Violet Crown Trail, which is kind of a weird name. There's a lot of history in our community about the Violet Crown, with our community historically being called that. But you know, we realized, and this sort of shows you the trail, a map of where the trail runs. One thing we realized early on was that not every jurisdiction had the same priorities. And so, you know, as I said earlier, we really had to find some specific ways to address all of the different priorities that made the different communities care about the project and actually want to participate. And so this project was born out of that. This is just sort of the mission statement that just sort of tells you, or our vision statement, just sort of written actually by all the communities together, surprisingly, but just sort of stating what we were trying to accomplish. And then the history, believe it or not, the project, and I'm not this old, but the project started in 1992, and the city of Austin originally initiated the project. And I think it's critical to talk about that, because until 2006, when we, Hill Country Conservancy, picked up the project, the city of Austin had no success in really getting other jurisdictions on board. And it really was a situation of, you know, I think of things in political terms, and it really was a situation of other jurisdictions not being all that excited about participating in a city of Austin project. And so had we had a regional government at that time, I think with every type of jurisdiction or every existing jurisdiction participating, I think everybody would have bought in a lot more quickly. But we just basically created that using a nonprofit that was seen as neutral, that had representatives from all of those jurisdictions participating. And so, you know, jurisdictions would feel like it was their project too and not just one particular city or one particular county. So funding, and you can scroll once more. We had to date, and actually we still have funding that we're getting for the project, but to date we have about $150 million in voter-approved bonds, and that is from a variety of jurisdictions. $750,000 in in-kind services, where we really got the corporate community to step up and prioritize the project and participate. And then $2 million in actual cash pledges from the local corporate community. We also had Texas Parks and Wildlife participate, and were able to get federal funds through appropriations and from other federal sources to try to make the project happen as well. So it was putting together a lot of different funding opportunities because there wasn't any centralized place to get those funds or allocate those funds from. So this just lists the project partners just to sort of give you guys an idea of the various entities that we had to work with. And you can scroll again. There were a lot. And, you know, no reason why this group couldn't have, the same work couldn't have been done by a regional government in its place. So the idea, again, is to link the trail to other Central Texas trail systems, and we think in doing that there will be more funding available. And ultimately, if we are successful, although we're far behind California, but if we are successful in getting regional governance, all of this would be turned over to the regional government because we still have the issue of figuring out who's going to keep this trail going and who's going to maintain it over the years. We also have another major project that the same entity has done. We were able to get four jurisdictions to pulled together a $10 million conservation collaboration to buy what all the jurisdictions agreed was the most critical, environmentally critical parcel of land in on the map that you guys saw earlier. And so we completed that in 2009, and I really put that up there just to show the example of the different kinds of projects that we'll do and the group will continue to do over time. And again, it's weird for a small nonprofit conservation entity to be doing this kind of work. It really needs to be done by a governmental entity. It would make a lot more sense. And I think that's it.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mead. And I think, just so you know, I don't think you guys are very far behind California. I can't imagine this sort of concept happening in California. So kudos to your success. Mark? Now we're going to learn about Hawaii, as we all know, a very interesting place to deal in land use.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for letting me speak today. I spent 2 years stationed down the road in Astoria, and I have to say that I really have to thank our host because in the 2 years that I lived here, I never saw a blue sky. And we got gray, dark gray, light gray, but never blue. So thanks to the city of Portland. Also, I'm here today to talk a little about the Hawaii experience in terms of land use controls. Hawaii seems to be kind of a unique place when you're on the mainland. Our birth certificates seem to be a little differently treated. My birth certificate looks a lot like another person's birth certificate, and so we were both born in a state of the United States. We do speak English. Our law school is ABA accredited. We have, I think, three alum in the room. And a professor, actually, who wrote a book, Land Use Controls in Hawaii. And so I won't make you read the whole book. You can just read my, 20 slides. But Robert Thomas was gracious enough to my firm and drove up here instead of flying. And so we took the extra money and bought a couple extra copies. Kudos to Professor Callies. You can get a couple free copies if you want to come pick it up. The final point I want to talk about more specifically on this topic is Hawaii has some really interesting land use issues that, and every case that seems to reach the U.S. Supreme Court from Hawaii seems to be an odd, weird property, real estate, land use case. For those of you who are more familiar with the Kelo versus City of New London case, everyone thought it was a big sea change. It caused a huge uproar in a lot of the legislatures. But if you thought that was an outlier, then you need to read the case that arose from Hawaii 20 years earlier, HHA versus Midkiff. And so with that context, that the lessons of Hawaii land use controls, I'd like to start. Hawaii started as an independent kingdom country, and we took an early, I think mid-1800s, peek at what a map of Honolulu looked like. And then the next slide shows the urban metropolis that it has become. In 1961, I think concerned that the neighbor island counties were ill-equipped to deal with the real estate development land use, or perhaps as a power grab, the Hawaii legislature passed a Chapter 205, which is a statewide land use classification system that classified all land in Hawaii at the state level. The key attributes of this statutory regime, it created four classifications of land use: urban, ag, or agriculture, conservation, and rural. It created a land use commission. It delegated powers to enforce these state land use classifications to the counties, but recently, or maybe not so recently, those powers seem to be not delegated, but rather held by the Land Use Commission. The main way you change a classification is through a boundary amendment. If you're going to change the boundary amendment for property less than 15 acres, the counties have those powers. If it's greater than 15 acres, that's reserved to the Land Use Commission. The Land Use Commission proceedings do allow for intervention, and Hawaii has pretty liberal standing requirements. I don't want to even call them requirements, but they're pretty permissive standing, and so most environmental or community groups can pretty easily intervene in Land Use Commission proceedings. The Land Use Commission does have the power to grant land uses via a special permit process. There are several statutory criteria which the Land Use Commission have to take into account when they are making their decisions. I will go through the different categories of land later, but you'll note that the land use classification process was heavily influenced by the prevailing economic factors at the time it was enacted in 1961. And so it seems to be that agricultural land classification is the default. So the current urban and projected urban uses were classified. The watershed areas and park areas were classified. And everything else seemed to be thrown into agriculture. And so you have most of the fight is reclassifying agricultural land to urban. And that's where we see historically has been the main controversy when it comes to the Land Use Commission. Finally, and so there are, I think, about 15 enumerated agricultural uses that are allowed in the agricultural district, wind farms, renewable energy, which look pretty urban in terms of their footprint on land, are both enumerated uses. So let's go through the specific classifications. Urban, there's no rocket science here. It does include residential use. It is controlled by the counties, and the counties can zone within the urban classification pretty liberally. The City and County of Honolulu does have preservation or parkland within the urban area. For those of you who've ever been to Hawaii, you'd think that Oahu's a pretty developed urban place. But you'll note that only 4% of the lands in the entire state are urban zone, or urban classified, excuse me. Agriculture, this is by far the largest amount of land in the state. I think it's hereditary from the intense land use of flowing from the sugarcane and pineapple plantations, to a lesser degree, the pineapple plantations. And so in order to further categorize agricultural lands, they do have soil ratings, with prime ag lands being the A and B soil ratings and the non-prime flowing from there. The statute does say that unless it's an enumerated use, it is not permitted, or it's prohibited. The goofy part about the way they classified it was ag was the default, and so you have non-agriculturally suitable lands, in Mark's opinion, being classified as ag lands. These are lava fields on the Big Island, which are ag classified. On Oahu, near my house, there's ag zone land, and it's very mountainous, not suitable, water problems. There's an unlikelihood that you could ever grow anything there. But it was the default. You have to keep in mind the lands in 1961, the powers that be, big landowners, wanted to preserve their power and maybe get a more favorable property tax rate by having it in ag. Conservation is defined. It's pretty much our watershed areas. If you look at the geography or topography of the Hawaiian Islands, it's most of the mountain areas are in conservation. And while there's a couple test cases on what you can do to develop in the conservation area, typically it's not a lot. The final odd one is there's a rural classification, which seems like it would do a lot to address some of the concerns about overdevelopment, loss of agricultural areas, congestion, traffic, etc. But statewide, it's only 2.2%. I don't think there's any rural land on Oahu. In fact, I think I have a slide of the only rural. The next slide, there is some rural land on Maui. And if you click through these, you'll see some of the documented areas. So the green areas on the left are the West Maui Mountain Range, the right are the Haleakala Mountain areas. The urban area on the north part of the saddle there is Kahului Wailuku, which is the main urban metropolitan area of Maui. You can see a lot of the ag lands, which in the central area were cane and still are to a lesser degree, and some pineapple. Those are really going out. And then the conservation areas for the watershed. That's my home and Robert's home island and Professor Callie's home island. You can see the green on the right side of the island is the Ko'olau Mountain Range, which is largely unsuited for any type of development or agricultural use anyway, but that's in the conservation area. The pink areas are urban. And the urban core is on the south, the middle part of the island, stretching really from Waikiki, which is on the southeast side of the island, all the way through now to the southwest side of the island, which is the Barbers Point area. Okay. Now, some of the lessons learned, there isn't a whole lot of case law to help you interpret the state land use controls at the in the Hawaii context, but there are two that I wanted to talk about today. The first was a interesting case where a developer wanted to develop a theme park out in on the southwest side of Oahu, and didn't want to go through a boundary amendment process to change it to urban, and so tried to get a special permit to develop the theme park on agricultural lands. It was poor soil, probably not suited well for agriculture anyway. And so they sought and obtained a special permit from the Land Use Commission. Now, the Hawaii Supreme Court in this decision, and you can see the site up there, went through the enumerated uses in the Land Use Chapter 205 statute and tried to match up the special permit requirement that a use be reasonable and of like character to those enumerated purposes. And plainly, a theme park is really more of an urban use with parking density, parking lots, etc. And so the Hawaii Supreme Court found that a special permit for that use was inappropriate and reversed that decision of the Land Use Commission. Of note, there is no theme park out in southwest Oahu. And so the next case is a little different. A developer sought to put a golf course on prime ag lands, which was soil classification A and B, by way of a special permit. Now, in the Chapter 205, golf courses are enumerated uses in ag lands, and in fact, an esteemed property professor from Hawaii talks a lot about how golf courses are great from a land banking perspective, preservation open space perspective. You can take a look at it in his book. I already graduated a couple years back, so I have no... he doesn't hold grades over me anymore. But golf courses at the time this case arose were pretty unpopular, seen as a rich person's pastime and not really open for the common persons. And so this case, a community group brought a challenge to the Land Use Commission to a decision to grant a special permit for a golf course. That did go up to the Hawaii Supreme Court, and they looked at it and said, you know, it's in the list of statutes. And despite the fact that this was prime soil for agriculture purpose, the legislature spoke and said the golf courses are a permitted use. So they said their special permit was okay. The legislature set, thank you for clarifying, the legislature set forth the enumerated uses in ag land, and the issue in this case was whether you could use the enumerated uses for golf course still applied on prime ag land soil, and the Supreme Court did say that it was okay. So some lessons learned from Hawaii, and of note, remember that Hawaii has given the land use field wonderful cases, like the Midkiff case, little case, what is that, Lingle versus Chevron? Is that another case that arose from Hawaii? And so from a historical perspective, I think that Hawaii's lesson really tended to show that it was a paternalistic attempt by the Hawaii legislature to protect the undeveloped or restrict development in the undeveloped areas of Hawaii, which particularly were the neighbor islands. At the time, the counties were very small, and Kauai County still is a very small place and has a lot of undeveloped lands. Times have changed. All the counties have urban planners. They have environmental specialists. They have very active community and civic groups who monitor land use decisions. And anyone who would like to see democracy in process in Hawaii, go on YouTube and click on Kauai Planning Commission. And you will be amazed at what goes on in these local governmental decisions. Amazed at the lack of civility, perhaps, too. From a practical perspective, and I do represent property owners, and I'm typically litigating against municipal governments, it does look like some of these zoning, a land use zoning for the statewide level, a land use zoning from the city or county level can be duplicative and may seem at cross purposes at times. Now that sustainability and green is becoming part of our politic, and in fact, side note, Robert toted up 70 green renewable grocery bags, and he's put them in the back there. If you'd like to grab one, please do. They do look blue, but they are green, and I think Maui County passed a law banning plastic bags. I know a lot of municipalities are looking at that, and so we decided to throw our firm name on it, and you know, you can have a takeaway. The difficulty, though, nowadays is when you're talking about changing classification from agricultural to urban, it is a tough sell with food security issues, sustainability, carbon footprint, climate change. The difficulty that we have or we try to convey is that in Hawaii, ag was the default, and everything got put into ag, even though there's no way that a farm would ever be productive or useful or economically feasible. And our final point is that the Land Use Commission can be a potent tool for challenge that can be used by anti-development groups to stop projects. And I think that's about it, and we can wait till afterwards to have questions.
And to pass out chocolate.
Yes, ma'am. First three, get chocolate.
All right. Thank you so much. Now I think we're going to come full circle with Mr. Cotugno coming back to Metro.
Okay. Thank you. And also welcome to our building. Before I get into the guts of my slideshow, I'd also give a couple of introductory remarks. It was mentioned that we receive a lot of visitors here, and we do receive a lot of visitors here. And we actually, because of that, formed an organization called First Stop Portland. We're a member of First Stop Portland, as are other units of government and businesses in the region housed at Portland State University to host visiting organizations that want to learn more about the story here. So if you want to explore more or if you want to come back later, First Stop Portland is our host that does the organization and taps into various parts of the community to figure out what's the best fit for the topics you're interested in. Secondly, there was a copy of my PowerPoint in your printed material, but it'll also be posted on the website, and I raise that because in the notes section of the PowerPoint is a series of sites that take you to source material, whether it's the particular document on Metro's webpage or the State Land Conservation and Development Commission's webpage or legislation or whatever the case might be. That takes you right directly into the details of all of those source materials. So that'll be available on your website, and Marcia Boone also has the slideshows that if you are interested in drilling down, she can get that for you. Next. First, starting with our setting, I think is important to understand because it really establishes kind of the original motivation for the state creating a land use program. What you see there is the Portland metropolitan region at the northern end of the state of Oregon, and more importantly, at the northern end of the Willamette Valley. The Willamette Valley is a very lush agricultural zone, and it was the same situation where agriculture and protection of agriculture in the 70s was the driving force behind creating a land use program. In addition, to the east and the west of the valley is the mountains, and that's the other major industry of Oregon back then, timber. And encroachment of urbanization into those timberlands and farmlands, which were the two economic bases of Oregon, is what created the crisis that the state legislature had to do something. You accompany that farmland down the Willamette Valley with an interstate freeway, and you provide very quick and easy access from the Portland metropolitan area to land that's cheap and easy to build on. And so the threat, especially to the ag land, was a very overriding concern. And it also created much the same kind of almost default ag first. I'll talk more about that later. Where there's very much of a protection attitude. We create the urbanization vision for the metropolitan area. The state program really does a lot more to create the rural protection program for ag and timber purposes and continues to do so today. Just a little profile on who we are. Portland Metro, as a district area, covers about 1.5 million people. It's not a majority of the state of Oregon, so we have to deal in the context of our legislature with a much more significant rural component of the population. And it's not the full metro region either. There's another 25-30% of the region's population on the Clark County, Washington side of the river under completely different statutes and governance. And so that creates an issue on coordinating. But we are the substantial part of the metropolitan area, and it does cover an area where there is a fairly high level of commonality of vision. And so there is a long history of the communities working together. The economic base of the region, while it's been timber and paper and ag, it's shifted definitely towards the high tech that Tom talked about, now growing into solar, a big clothing and shoe presence, starting with Nike, but expanding very much beyond that. A lot of metals functions that actually grew out of cheap hydro and building airplanes and ships during the war that has continued to be high level of metals related, railroad car manufacturing and barges and you name it, even trucks. So a pretty diverse economic base, and a economic base that is disproportionately higher than the rest of the country in industry. So we're probably double the national share of employment that's in industry-based.
Next.
Now, a few words about Metro itself. We came into existence as an elected form of government and as a government, not a council of governments, in 1979. And this is the district maps for the Metro councilors. The important thing being they're Metro councilors. They run for office to the Metro Council seat and have done so since 1979. To create Metro, we were enabled by legislation that the voters then had to approve. Subsequently, we asked to have our own Home Rule Charter established, and that did require constitutional authority that the statewide voters had to approve to amend that constitution so that it says cities, counties, and Metro can have a Home Rule Charter. So we are constitutionally based, and as a result, we are created through a charter of a voter approval of our own citizens. So because of councilors running for election every 2 years, tax measures being on the ballot every few years for a variety of topics, elective office, elective activities tends to raise the profile of the organization. So councils of governments tend to be fairly invisible. We tend to be pretty visible and transparent. And because of the elective nature of the running for office, the candidates run on Metro issues. They don't run on local issues, and that raises the profile of those Metro issues as well. Next. We are a distinctly urban district. The red line is our boundary, and it is very tight to the metropolitan, the urbanized part of the metropolitan area. The purple areas are the counties. They have a much larger rural territory and, frankly, get distracted on a lot of other issues that we don't have to worry about. We are an urban-based focus. The COG, that was the predecessor organization to Metro, actually did encompass those full four counties, including Clark County, Washington, plus Columbia County in the north there. So it was a much larger territory, and as a result, you sort of end up working to the lowest common denominator that the entire group can agree to, and that COG was much more distracted to a lot of issues that we frankly don't deal with. We deal with issues that are clearly central to the urban part of the metropolitan area. We do have the same kind of fragmented city organization within the metro region, and it does create the kind of need for coordination that the professor talked about. And the range is astounding, from as small as a few hundred population in an incorporated city to the big city of Portland at 550,000 plus, and everywhere in between, with a fair amount of unincorporated county population that is a very tough governance situation, not being in a city, creating difficulties there. Nonetheless, although we're not a COG, we do have quite close working relationships to the local governments, and I'll talk about that a bit more as well. This rather washed out aerial photograph is duplicated on the wall back there. So as you're having lunch, I'd invite you to take a look at the aerial on the wall. And the most notable thing you'll see is you can actually see where the urban growth boundary is. And it's because the ag land on the other side of that urban growth boundary really is well protected. We don't have jurisdiction outside our boundary, and most of that territory that is in ag is outside our boundary. They're regulated by the counties, but they're regulated by the counties under a consistent state land use program that Tim talked about, where there's a pretty prescribed set of allowed uses, much like Hawaii, that can take place on those rural lands. So while it's outside our jurisdiction, there isn't going to be sprawl across the landscape in that rural territory because of the way we operate within the construct of a broader state program. Next. This is our key sort of formal organized linkage to local governments, whereby the Metro Council, while it does have authority to make certain kinds of decisions, does it very much in consultation with local governments. We are the designated MPO, and under federal law, the MPO decision-making structure must include local elected officials of general purpose governments, and the Metro Council is not a local elected official nor a general purpose government, and therefore cities and counties must be part of that decision-making structure. In addition, MPOs must include major transportation service providers as part of the governance structure, and so the transit district, the highway department, the port, marine and airport operators are part of that decision-making structure as well. Anything that's federally related, which is pretty broad, dealing with the long-range plans and the short-range allocation of federal funds, must go through the J-PACT, and they must make a recommendation to the Metro Council, which the Metro Council can accept or reject. They can't change and substitute some other decision from the J-PACT recommendation. What it does do is create sort of a balance where J-PACT does tend to be a collection of various interests. They're there to represent their interest, but the Metro Council provides that sort of regional overlay. Is it good for a particular local government or transportation service provider, and is it good for the region as a whole? The Metro Council provides that balance. Back up. Because J-PACT has been in operation because when the old COG went away and the new Metro was created, there was a need for continuity in the MPO status because money's at stake. And so J-PACT has been in that role since the creation of Metro in 1979. In the late 80s, as Metro was forming its own charter and was starting to explore the land use business — we were not in the land use business except the urban growth boundary at that point in time — we imposed upon ourselves, if you will, the requirement to have MPACT, the group on the right, and they're written into our charter as an important group that we would consult with on any matter that might impact the land use regulations of a local government. So between the two of these, we're continuously consulting with local governments on land use and transportation related matters. Tom touched a bit on the other functions of Metro just briefly. I'm talking about the land use and transportation connection and, to some extent, the parks and natural areas connection. We actually own a large park system. Besides disposing of solid waste, we actually recycle more of the material than we dispose of. The convention center across the street and performing arts center, the zoo Tom mentioned. Go ahead. So I'm going to talk about some of the forces and tactics that we've used to accomplish what we've accomplished. The forces that led to some of the motivation to implement this in the first place, and then the tactics that we've used from both a regulatory framework to create a plan and a set of regulations to implement that plan, but just as importantly, an investment strategy that that plan guides as well. And it's not one or the other, it's really how the two fit together and work together. And these are the areas that I'm going to focus on around that both regulatory and investment oriented focus. But to the history of where we got to where we are, in the 70s and early 80s, there were a number of major forces that kind of came together that led us to the direction we're pursuing. Like many urban areas, the central city core was in decline. The city of Portland was the active party around reclaiming the downtown and implementing the redevelopment efforts to accomplish, frankly, what we've done in the downtown area now. And to do that in a context of keeping families in the central city, not allowing that kind of decline and movement out of the central city area. So the central city and the concern about the central city was one of the major driving forces that impacted us. The second one was a revolt over a freeway expansion system. In this case, we actually took out the highway along the waterfront on the lower slide and created a park along the downtown waterfront. But equally, in the same time period, we canceled the plan for several hundred miles of additional expressway expansion, and in particular canceled two that were in the imminently going to be built that would have displaced substantial housing in the southeast part of the region and industry in the northwest part of the region, and did that in a period when we were able to be part of a national reform that allowed us to shift those dollars into other transportation purposes. That was sort of part of the evolution of the federal program from a strictly interstate-oriented focus to a more multimodal and flexible funding decision structure shift that we were a major part of. So the activity around shifting from controversial and very disruptive freeways towards multimodal decision-making around transportation dollars and a multimodal emphasis on building the system was a key part of that transition as well. Different kind of force than just the downtown redevelopment concern. And then the third one was the one I really opened with, that is the Oregon story around land use control and the concern about preserving ag land and timberland. This is the one where if the metropolitan area is allowed to continue to sprawl down I-5, there's a lot of loss of agricultural land, and that led to the state really being active around creating the overall land use framework that we all operate within. That's our governor that was the lead, provided the leadership role to create the program, as well as a number of other landmark activities like the bottle bill and the beach bill and a few other things. But from a land use point of view, it's the framework that we operate within for both land use and transportation purposes. Again, the notes page provides the linkage to all of these laws and regulations that give you the details of how it's implemented. The centerpiece, obviously, of the overall land use program is the urban growth boundary. It really is the dividing line, and it's all the whole thing is organized around encouraging and supporting and directing a particular kind of urbanization inside that boundary, and restricting urbanization, restricting public facilities outside that boundary, limiting permitted uses to what you could reasonably define as agriculture and timber supportive outside that boundary. So the whole framework is defined that way. And again, the judge talked about this morning, it's a prescriptive system. It's not simply this is what you're allowed to do in comprehensive plans. No, it's this is what you must do in comprehensive plans. And there's a set of standards established that define minimum requirements out of local comprehensive plans. The long list of goals on the left is all the various topics that the state program provides this sort of direction and guidance around. And again, if you go to the webpage, you'll see for each one of these a goal, which gives you sort of the philosophy and aspiration of what's trying to be accomplished. But you'll also see the administrative rule that gives you the details of what's permitted, how it's administered, how decisions are made, and all those kind of things. So we operate within the framework of all of those administrative rules on the left. Go back. And then on the right, Metro's regulatory framework is designed around a regional framework plan, the 2040 growth concept, et cetera, and then local plans operate within that. So we have the authority to adopt a regional framework plan. We have to do it consistent with the state direction, but then local plans have to be consistent with the metro plans. The metro plans, in some cases, are written to be aspirational and a guideline, and in other cases are written with very specific requirements that the local plans have to be consistent with. And all of that gets worked out any time the Metro Council is going to consider an ordinance that would adopt a regulation, it must consult with MPAC and get their input before that happens. So there's quite a lot of cooperation through that process. In the late 80s, we initiated what was really the visioning process. Through the decade of the 80s, Metro had quite an active transportation-related function because of the decisions to cancel freeways and shift money, and therefore, if there's money on the table, there's a lot of work associated with how you're going to spend that money and then implementing the projects that come about from that money. And that got us into the whole light rail development business. Nonetheless, all of that time period from the mid-70s through the 80s had a significant transportation function, but the land use function of Metro at that time was one person dealing with the urban growth boundary, and it was really the mayors that came to Metro and said, there's more to growth management than the line. It's all about what happens inside the line and what do we want to be and what common aspirations do we have, and how do we work together, and how do we deal with the kind of cross-jurisdictional issues that the professor was talking about, where the action of one party impacts the other party. And we went through this visioning process to look at different scenarios for different shapes of urban form and the different transportation decisions that complement those different choices of urban form that really provided the framework for the decisions that led to what we're operating under is the 2040 growth concept. Next. So the 2040 growth concept that we've now had in place for about 15 years has a pretty remarkable level of understanding and commitment behind it throughout the region. Some of the key features of the 2040 growth concept are this notion of developing in centers, a whole series of centers throughout the region, regional centers that are intended to provide larger places of commerce, town centers that are intended to provide more neighborhood service access, good connections of transportation to those centers. It's in those places where we're looking for the increases in density, we're looking for the mix, we're looking for the emphasis on walking and transit, things like that. And with an emphasis on centers, it drives a lot of the implementation activities that we get involved with, whether it's investing our money or local government money into making those happen. Next. Very different from centers is industry. The land needs are different. The transportation needs are different. It's so important to the economic base of the region that there's quite a significant focus in that plan on the industrial component, where we're interested in preserving that as a good industrial land. It needs just as much protection as ag land, frankly, to avoid encroachment by the big box, by the churches, by the parks, by the schools, by the hospitals, where we really need it for the economic base, and we take steps to protect it for that purpose. And it needs good truck access, and so the transportation investment strategy towards those places is quite different than the center's focus as well. Next. And the overall intent of this strategy is to maintain that urban growth boundary as tight as possible in order to not encroach on the rural lands. Associated with maintaining a tight urban growth boundary, we're just now finishing, it's not finished yet, but we're just now finishing a process of establishing what we refer to as urban and rural reserves. Clearly, the urban growth boundary is the key, you know, regulatory framework tool that impacts this. Go back. That impacts this interest in preserving rural lands. Under the state law, we're required to review the urban growth boundary every 5 years and ensure that it has a 20-year capacity of land supply inside that urban growth boundary, and if it doesn't, to make adjustments accordingly. Our policy preference is to make adjustments that get better utility out of the land we already have, upzoning or investment that gets a redevelopment to happen. If we can create capacity through those kinds of actions and either avoid or minimize expansion of the urban growth boundary, that's our preference. But we do have a requirement to provide that 20-year land supply, and if it requires urban growth boundary expansion, then we're mandated to do that. It's up to us to figure out where, but heretofore, much like the ag legacy that you were talking about, the urban growth boundary decisions have historically been based on where is it the least damaging to ag, not where is it the best urban community. The urban and rural reserves process that we just went through is a result of special legislation that we sought out of our legislature, whereby we could, in a partnership manner, work with our three counties to identify urban reserve areas based more on the philosophy of what's the best area for expansion for urban qualities, but at the same time adopt a set of rural reserves that would be off limits, so that if we adopt urban reserves that say this is our 50-year expansion area, not 20, but 50-year expansion area, the rural reserves would be off limits for urban growth boundary expansion for that same 50-year period. So we've adopted, knock on wood, so have the counties adopted it, knock on wood, and it's now in front of the LCDC Commission for ratification in August. If they adopt it and it doesn't go to court, or if it does go to court and succeeds in court, then that'll put into place a layer, an overlay, that our urban growth boundary decisions must be made in the context of into the future. That is, we'd still have a requirement to do a five-year review. We'd still have a requirement to maintain a 20-year land supply. We'd still have a policy preference to do that by making the land we already have more efficient, but if we need to do urban growth boundary expansions, we would, and we would do it into the urban reserves, and we'd be prohibited from doing it into the rural reserves. Rough numbers, our current urban growth boundary is about 250,000 acres. The urban reserve portion adds another roughly 25,000 acres. So in rough numbers, that means the 50-year urban land footprint is about 275,000 acres. The rural reserve component that we've just adopted as well is about 275,000 acres. So the ag industry has confidence that we're not going to nibble away at their back door in that 275,000 acres for at least the next 50 years, and vice versa. We know where we're going over the next 50 years into those urban reserves, and so we can make more rational decisions on future infrastructure planning and things like that, where prior to urban reserves, we might have gone anywhere in any direction around the region. So that's an improvement that we have hopes will provide some benefit around. Next. And you were talking about open space. We found open space is a very strong driver as well. The popularity with the public has really been quite significant. And importantly, it's as much or more important inside the boundary as it is outside the boundary. The boundary, in effect, creates open space, preserves open space outside the boundary. It's working open space, farm and forest lands, and some natural areas. But inside the boundary is where the bargain with the community is we are going to use the land more efficiently. We are going to minimize expansion. That means there's going to be higher densities. But some open space accompanying that higher density has been an important feature and has had broad political support as a result. Next. Again, back to the notes section of the slideshow, this provides the links to take you to the specific Metro Code requirements. The way the Metro structure is set up, the regional framework plan sort of describes the broad vision and the policies that we're trying to accomplish. The regulatory relationship between us and local governments is done through this document called the Urban Growth Management Functional Plan. So there's a lot in the vision, but there are very specific things and not necessarily covering all the topics that represent the kinds of regulatory requirements that local governments comply with. Things dealing with housing densities, providing for employment lands, water quality and stream setback requirements, limitations on land uses that can go into industrial areas so that they stay industrial purposes, incentives and support for development of mixed use and centers. Next, housing affordability, planning in new urban areas as we do expand the urban growth boundary. Title 13, Nature Neighborhoods, is a wildlife protection program through regulatory setbacks and things like that inside the urban growth boundary. Next. We continue to have a significant transportation focus in this building, but we've really done quite a lot to emphasize transportation is not just about mobility. Transportation is not just about moving people faster. It's about building communities too. And so we've got as much on the right-hand side where a transportation investment in a main street, for example, or the redevelopment of a main street is really about the character of the street and how it fits into that downtown environment more so than it is about moving people faster. On the left-hand side are transportation projects that are moving people faster. We certainly have a multimodal focus around moving people faster, but the plan itself is as much about those placemaking types of transportation investments as it is those mobility investments. Next. Couple of examples, the next two, are some of the details, again, some of the regulatory interface that we have with local governments. A interconnected local street system is an important feature. The tendency is to not make those street connections, but to have cul-de-sacs and a circuitous street pattern as well. So we've required that there be intersections every 300 to 500 feet so that you have a connected street system rather than an emphasis on cul-de-sacs. And that's the kind of thing where if one jurisdiction is going to implement it, it needs to happen in the neighbor because that system operates as a network, not as an isolated part of the system. Similarly, next, we've adopted parking requirements. So that if in one downtown a local government is trying to limit parking, that the development just doesn't pop up in the next downtown where there's the ability to get lots of free parking. So there's some standards that establish maximums on how much parking can be implemented through new development. Next. Clearly, most of transportation, however, is not about a regulatory framework. It's about an investment framework. And light rail has been our biggest tool towards investment in a way that isn't just making transportation investment, it's making urban form investment as well. So we've got quite an aggressive expansion of our transit system with light rail, streetcar, commuter rail. Next. And we've been on a steady track to expand the system over time. Next. So as a result, you see the coverage of our system. All the red lines are now up and operating. They're kind of faded, but the yellow lines towards the south and across the river into Clark County towards the north are the next ones that are teed up to be implemented in the near future. We've just started construction on the southeast line. Next. And then on the natural areas, again, we've done quite a lot through preservation from voter-approved bond measures, two of them, as well as from the regulatory development requirements of setting back from stream corridors. So all told from inside the urban growth boundary, next, both through land that was already in parks plus land that we've acquired inside the boundary from those bond measures, this gives you an illustration, 22,000 total acres inside the boundary through an acquisition-oriented approach, next, plus from the regulatory framework of development, impacting development, the stream corridors, another, 27,000 acres from those regulations. So next, the combination of those two produces about 19% of the total UGB as protected nature inside the city, not just outside the city. The bond measure, in addition, has acquired large blocks where there really are good, big, intact parcels that can be assembled of natural areas outside the boundary as well. And then finally, public-private partnerships. We really do quite a lot in partnership with local governments to drive investments of various kinds of public expenditures to impact private development. The private investment is the big dollars. The public investment is really the catalyst dollars. But we're looking for the kind of investment that leads to the kind of form that we're interested in particular in those centers and corridors and around transit. Next. We have a transit-oriented development program. This gives you sort of a hierarchy of where they invest based upon where the market is the ripest to invest, whereby we put money directly into the development to result in a higher density or a greater level of mix than what the market would otherwise provide. Next. And then just some examples. The big granddaddy example is the Pearl District just north of downtown Portland. Our TOD program, we tend to focus in the suburbs because Portland doesn't need our help. they've got resources and capabilities without us being involved. And so our TOD program tends to be smaller developments next throughout the rest of the metropolitan area. So major investment in things like light rail, smaller scale investment in things like TODs, a strong regulatory framework for the overall state land use program and the 2040 growth concept, and then specific regulatory framework from the Urban Growth Management Functional Plan that provides a direct tie to local plans. Back to you, Nadia.
All right. Thank you so much. And I know we're getting close to running out of time here, although there is a hot topic lunch at noon that hopefully everyone is going to stay for.
And so you need at least three questions.
Yes, that's what we want to at least push through the three questions so we get to pass out chocolate. And I'm sure given all of the information that was provided today, there have got to be more than three questions out there. Anyone? I know you're hungry, so. All right. Thanks, Andy.
Hi, this is Andy Gowder. And Nikhil, I think I want to direct this specifically maybe to everybody else. You talked a little bit about how challenging it was dealing from an NGO standpoint with some of these issues. But I know in South Carolina we have found that, particularly given the sort of prevailing cultural attitudes and political attitudes of some folks that the NGO process is often a better process for larger planning, particularly with open space preservation and conservation. And I wondered if you wanted, or anybody else wanted to comment on whether they had seen other circumstances where perhaps a planning process or a regionalism process from an NGO standpoint had worked maybe better than from a state or local government standpoint.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody else wants to comment, but I'll start. We actually looked at that in our region, and I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of merit to it. I think it's in many ways a better system. We just can't quite get there. So I don't know if anybody else has experience with that or looked at the NGO concept.
Well, while we've had two successful tax measures that have raised money to buy land, and we've therefore been in the active business for 15 years of buying land, NGOs are a significant part of the overall program here as well. There's quite a number of different organizations that are sort of the grassroots foundation of support out there that were very involved in pushing us to do these things. You can't lead unless people follow, and they create the ingredients for people to follow. They were the troops that helped campaign for ballot measures. And right now, in fact, we're in the process of forming something we call the Intertwine, whereby it's a fragmented system. There are lands that are owned by conservation organizations. There's lands that are owned by Metro. There's lands that are owned by cities and counties. And it does need to function like a system. Yeah. So the Intertwine is all of those parties working together to brand it as a single identity, to make the connections between the different parts of the system, so that from both nature's point of view and the consumer's point of view, it doesn't matter who it belongs to. So NGOs are that's actually being created as an NGO to be that sort of central organizing group. So NGOs are essential.
Yeah, and our experience is just that the funding takes everybody sort of being at the table, so we've not really been able to avoid having all the parties sort of controlling the process, which is not necessarily efficient, by the way.
All right. Another question? Rob?
Robert Thomas. These are for the Oregon folks. Any experience with interstate issues, given your proximity to Washington? I mean, if I don't like the regional government here, does my industry flee over the border? And is there any future for interstate regional government?
I'll start, and then Andy has more hands-on experience with this than I do. But the big issue right now, of course, in this region is the construction of a new bridge on I-5 over the Columbia River, which is about a $3.6 billion project altogether and would carry light rail to Vancouver. Vancouver, by the way, or Clark County, I should say, has at least once or maybe twice voted down light rail. And so there is some question about whether Vancouver will accept a smaller version of light rail and a more compressed electorate. But that project has required bi-state cooperation. In some respects, maintaining a tight urban growth boundary with a jurisdiction relatively easily commute to the north that has much different and somewhat more relaxed land use standards is like having a hole in the balloon you're trying to blow up. And so working back and forth with them, their leadership up there, there's elements of their leadership up there that would like to see them move in a direction that is more aligned with what Oregon is, but they get some pushback from the usual folks who push back on those things. And there is a constant bitterness between the two real estate communities because Vancouver has a tendency occasionally to promote their housing stock by creating an unfavorable picture of what goes on in Oregon. And so our real estate people are sometimes not very happy with that. we're beginning more and more to treat it as an economic region. So they belong to our economic development district, and they are part of a new organization that is formed called Greenlight Greater Portland, which is now merged private sector with the public sector economic development folks on both sides of the river. And they also serve on the Metropolitan Policy Advisory Council as they don't get a vote, and on JPAC, and I believe they do vote on JPAC, yeah. Don't they? As part of the MPO. So there's lots of examples of bi-state cooperation, and Andy has actually been at the heart of that for our organization. So
I'll tell you a couple stories. About maybe 15 years ago, I was at the MPO board in Clark County's meeting, and out of the blue, the Clark County commissioner pointed at me and said, because of you, Clark County is the horse capital of the United States. And I said, what are you talking about?
And is that a compliment or was it an insult?
The limitations on rural residential outside our urban growth boundary forced that market to the other side of the river. They are more lax in their rural territory. It's pretty easy to get a 5-acre permit for a residential house that's not farm related. And so the demand for rural residential, whatever share of the metropolitan population that represents, it got concentrated over there, and it turns out they are the horse capital of the United States because they've got all of our horses of what would otherwise happen on our rural territory. So they were impacted by our regulations. That in turn impacts us because a lot of them drive back into Portland to take jobs. And that really creates the clash of values around the Columbia River Crossing project. For years, they were seeking another bridge. For years, we were seeking a light rail extension. In both cases, as standalone projects. They didn't want our light rail project. We didn't want their bridge. But the combination might be a formula for success, and that's we're close to a conclusion on building a replacement bridge that has both. And we'll see.
I have to say, I had a question for Mark. With the state controlling zoning, how long does it take if you need to change the zoning?
Well, she just wants the candy.
No, I'm giving it away. And he said a long, long, long time.
Yeah, one of the pieces that I didn't really address was that you place power with the Land Use Commission, and then you give it zero budget, zero staff, and it becomes a real impediment. The other challenge is the environmental studies required to support a boundary amendment. So if you were talking about a boundary amendment from ag to urban, it is a, I would say, 2-3 year process at least. You know, assuming you do an environmental impact statement, I represented a interested party that challenged environmental impact statement or lack thereof for a big development project, and it was a 20-year process. Or as a 20-year-old project, it was just started to get going, and we stopped it for, I think, 3 years of litigation, and so it can be really disruptive. Now, if it's less than 15 acres, and most of Oahu, you're talking about less than 15-acre zone changes, it can be a quicker process because you don't have to do the EIS.
All right, I think we're about to wrap up here. I know there is a box lunch available, and I also just want to make a pitch. I think everyone here has seen what a wonderful job that Metro has done in terms of making the urban forum that is Portland attract us all here, and there is a mobile workshop happening at 1:30 today, so please, I think, Tamara, there's room for folks to join, so please jump on board and come see Portland. All right, thank you to all of our speakers, and thank you to everyone for joining us.